This program was first broadcast on Canterbury's community access radio station Plains FM 96.9 and was made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Welcome to Earthwise, Environment and Peace with Justice interviews on Plains FM 96.9.
Welcome to Earthwise. I'm Lois Griffiths. For today's program, Martin and I am honored to be talking with a very distinguished American legal scholar, political analyst, social critic, as well as professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law in San Diego, California, Marjorie Cohn.
Well, Lois and I are both worried that the whole concept of international law, Geneva Conventions, humanitarian law, and others are being challenged and undermined. Welcome to Earthwise, Marjorie Cohn.
Thank you for having me, Martin and Lois.
Well, Marjorie, on the 14th of April, the U.S., joined by Britain and France, committed some bombing strikes on locations in Syria. These strikes were not authorized by the U.N., and Syria was not about to attack America. Were they legal under international law, and is there such a concept?
Is there a concept of legality of use of force under international law? Yes, there is. Were these strikes legal? No, they were not. They violated the United Nations Charter, which the U.S. has ratified, making it part of U.S. law under the Constitution. And the Charter says that countries shall refrain in their international relations from the threat or use of force against the territorial integrity or political independence of any state. There are two very limited exceptions to the Charter's prohibition on the use of force. One is when a country is acting in self-defense after an armed attack, and the other is when the Security Council has authorized it. And once the Security Council takes jurisdiction over the issue, then the use of force has to stop. Neither of those two things occurred before the Trump administration and France and the UK bombed Syria. It was not self-defense because it was not in response to an armed attack by Syria against another state, and the Security Council did not approve of the airstrikes. And the UN Special Envoy for Syria, Staffan de Mistura, called for compliance with the Security Council Resolution 2401, which was passed in February of 2018. And in that resolution, the Security Council demanded an immediate cessation of hostilities to enable humanitarian assistance and medical evacuation. But that resolution 2401 ends by stating that the Security Council, quote, decides to remain actively seized of the matter, unquote. That means that the Security Council, and only the Council, had the legal authority to order any measures, forceful or otherwise. In fact, under Article 51 of the UN Charter, Bashar Assad, the president of Syria, would have a valid self-defense claim if it wanted to retaliate against the United States. And this is not really called retaliation. It's called acting in self-defense because there was an armed attack on Syria. And Assad could have asked Russia to act with it in collective self-defense under Article 51 of the UN Charter. Now, Trump decried the humanitarian disaster created by the gas attack in Syria, and the thing is that there is no proof that Bashar Assad was responsible for a sarin gas attack. Even James Mattis admitted that. Even if it had been proved that Bashar Assad was responsible for a sarin gas attack, that still would not have constituted an armed attack under the UN Charter to justify the use of military force. So the attack on Syria by the U.S.-led forces with the U.K. and France participating violated the UN Charter. And I should say that a year before, almost to the day, Trump had sent 59 Tomahawk missiles to attack a site in Syria in retaliation against an alleged sarin gas attack. And even James Mattis said the United States had no evidence that the Assad government used sarin gas against the Syrian people. The U.S. government refuses to make public its legal justification for that 2017 U.S. military strike on Syria, notwithstanding a lawsuit filed by Protect Democracy, which is a group of former Obama administration lawyers who filed a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit to make public the Trump administration's memo that ostensibly details its legal justification for that 2017 military strike. The Trump administration claims that memo is classified, but Protect Democracy in discovery learned that the classified portion could easily be redacted or edited out. So, yes, the airstrikes against Syria are illegal under international law and also illegal under U.S. law. The War Powers Resolution, which Congress passed in the wake of the Vietnam War to reclaim its constitutional war authorizing power, and the War Powers Resolution allows the U.S. president to introduce U.S. forces into hostilities or imminent hostilities only in three instances: when Congress has declared war, which didn't happen before the Syria airstrikes, or when there's an attack on the United States or its armed forces, which also had not happened, or when when Congress has passed specific statutory authorization, and Congress had not done that. There were authorizations for the use of military force that Congress gave George W. Bush in 2001 and 2002. Neither of those would have justified this Syria airstrike. The 2001 had to do with Al-Qaeda and individuals and groups responsible for the 9/11 attacks. Bashar Assad had nothing to do with that. And the 2002 authorization for the use of military force only allowed Bush or the president, says the president, but it was at that time George W. Bush, to use force or all necessary measures, it says, to get Saddam Hussein out of Iraq. And once that was accomplished, that 2002 AUMF, authorization for use of military force, was no longer operational.
Well, Marjorie, the Trump administration has broken the UN charter and violated U.S. law. Is that the end of the story then?
Well, it's not the end of the story. In fact, U.S. leaders could be prosecuted for war crimes in the International Criminal Court. The prosecutor of the International Criminal Court has launched a preliminary examination of U.S. leaders' possible commission of war crimes in Afghanistan. And for the most part, the International Criminal Court has only brought criminal charges against African leaders, but she is considering other countries as well. For example, she is considering whether Israel has committed war crimes against humanity in Gaza, and to a lesser extent, whether Palestinian groups have also committed violations of international law. But that's in the preliminary examination stage. She has not launched a formal investigation. So there is a possibility that this could be redressed in the International Criminal Court.
What about
also, I should say that that's what I was going to say.
Well, okay, you mentioned the ICC, but what about within the U.S. itself? Is there any movement to say, well, look, this is wrong, we have to, well, impeach the president if he breaks the law?
Certainly some people are talking about that, but it, unfortunately, at least in my mind, that is not in the cards, at least at this point, because the House of Representatives is the body that would vote for impeachment by 51%, and since the Republicans control the House of Representatives at least until the midterm elections in 2018, that would be the beginning of 2019, that would not happen. Now, if the Democrats were to take back the majority of the House of Representatives, then theoretically they could vote to impeach the president. But that's not the end of it, because impeachment is like a prosecutor bringing a charge. Then the case would move to the Senate, and the Senate would have a trial, and in order to convict Trump and remove him from office, two-thirds of the Senate would have to agree, and that's not going to happen even if the Democrats were to take back the majority of the Senate. They would not be able to reach the two-thirds majority. So I don't think that's realistic. Now, there is, as I'm sure you know, an investigation by a special counsel called Robert Mueller, who is investigating the Trump administration and appears Donald Trump himself for collusion with Russia, for a cover-up, for obstruction of justice, probably for money laundering. I don't know that it would actually, that investigation would be expanded to cover a possible commission of war crimes, because Congress, quite frankly, has shown, Democrats and Republicans alike, with a couple of exceptions, Bernie Sanders and a couple of others, have shown little appetite for criticizing Trump's use of military force. They don't want to be accused of being soft on terrorism, they don't want to imperil national security, even though, in my opinion, Trump is actually imperiling national security by his bombing of Syria and use of drones in other countries, killing many, many civilians, and also threats against North Korea and Iran, although that's, there are negotiations going on. We'll see what happens with North Korea and Iran.
That's, I think, what we meant by saying, is there such a concept? This whole idea of law and order doesn't apply at the highest level, does it?
Well, law and order is there are laws on the books. There's the Constitution. There are federal statutes. There are international treaties, which the ones the U.S. has ratified, as I said, are part of U.S. law. But then the question is, yes, that's the rule of law. Who will enforce the rule of law? Will government authorities enforce it? Not at this point, given the fact that Trump's people, the Republicans, seem to care more about tax cuts and packing the court with right-wing Supreme Court justices who are going to do away with reproductive rights, gay rights, etc., than they are concerned about following the rule of law. And that is just the reality of the situation now in the United States, unfortunately.
You're listening to Earthwise, broadcasting in Christchurch on Plains FM 96.9. in Hamilton on Free FM, and in Waikanae on Coast Access FM. Today's guest is distinguished American legal scholar Marjorie Cohn.
Well, Marjorie, let's get on to Gaza.
Okay.
And
yes, there have been killings in Gaza, killings by the Israeli Defense Forces, by Israel, supported by the United States. The United States funds Israel to the tune of $3.8 billion a year, and that's mostly military aid and assistance. And the Trump administration has been has had nothing but praise for Israel's killing of Palestinians during the Great March of Return, which is started on March the 30th and is to last for 6 weeks. Every Friday, Palestinians march to the border, camp by the border, and it's a protest in favor of their right to return, their lawful right to return to the lands from which they were expelled in 1948, in what they call the Nakba, the Great Catastrophe, when about some 800,000 Palestinians were expelled from their homes in order to create Israel. And so at this point, there have been 42 Palestinians killed, and these are unarmed Palestinians who've been killed by Israeli snipers near the border. More than 5,500 Palestinians have been injured. More than 1,700 of those incidents involve the use of live ammunition by Israeli soldiers. 4 children were shot by Israeli soldiers, and a total of 233 children have been injured by the Israeli Defense Forces using live ammunition. The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Zayed Raad al-Hussein, said on Friday, urged the Israeli government to address its military's use of excessive deadly force against Palestinian civilians. And Zayed cited the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which says everyone has the right to freedom and of peaceful assembly and association. And Zayed said it's difficult to see how tire burning or stone throwing or even Molotov cocktails, which allegedly have been thrown by Palestinians, from a significant distance at heavily protected security forces in defensive positions can be seen to constitute such a threat. And Zayed also cited the unlawful use of force against civilians protected by the Fourth Geneva Convention. The other thing that's very worrisome is that there was a report, the Ministry of Health in Gaza said that Israeli forces used an unknown gas against unarmed peaceful Palestinians on the fifth consecutive Friday of the Great March of Return protests. And they were these gas canisters were randomly fired toward protesters, and they caused suffocation, convulsion, and extreme vomiting to dozens of protesters. So that is very, very worrisome. There was an interview with Al Jazeera interviewed Jihad al-Jawadi, who is director of the ICU, the intensive care unit at the Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza, where the injured Palestinians were taken. And al-Jawadi told Al Jazeera that all of the injured people who came to the hospital after the first March 30th day of protest, when 20 people were killed, were shot in the head, pelvic joints, or knee joints. And he said this shows that Israeli forces were shooting to kill or to cause disabilities. And B'Tselem, which is a Jerusalem-based human rights organization, said the military orders given the Israeli Defense Forces were shoot to kill unarmed Palestinians taking part in the demonstrations. Senior IDF officers told IDF is the Israeli Defense Force. Officers told Haaretz before the March 30th protest that a large number of casualties was, quote, a price we would be willing to pay to prevent a breach of the fence at the border.
The impunity with
wondering
which,
who's paying the price.
Yeah.
Who is paying the price? It's a price in public relations. The UN is speaking out, and in the world community, there is certainly a mobilization of shame against what the Israeli government is doing. And in the United States, we don't see this because our government, through all of the administrations, has uncritically supported the Israeli government, including during its last three massacres in Gaza, the 2014 massacre, resulted in the deaths of 2,200 Palestinians. And yet we don't hear in the United States criticism of this because our government is so so uncritical of it, and those in Congress don't want to upset their pro-Israel base, so they aren't critical of it, with a few exceptions. But in the rest of the world, there is tremendous criticism against Israel for the way it is treating the Palestinians. And under the Fourth Geneva Convention, an occupying power, and Israel is certainly occupying the Palestinian territories, an occupying power has a responsibility, a legal responsibility, to protect the occupied, not to kill them, you know, unarmed protesters with bullets and then claim, oh, we were acting in self-defense, when the Palestinians were unarmed.
I'm afraid there's not been any criticism here by our government or our media. I wonder what it would take to get people really angry. And I've been wondering about the fact that journalists have been targeted with wearing protective flak jackets with press in large letters. I would expect the world's media people would be furious about this.
Yes, well, there have been journalists that were killed by Israeli snipers at the border, and they use tear gas, and so it's hard to tell what's happening. At least that's the excuse the Israelis give. But these snipers are poised a good deal away, a good distance away, but they have scopes on their rifles, and they've been picking people off, including journalists. Now, I think that journalists are critical here, both to bring the facts and the stories to public awareness, but also images of what these Israeli bullets are doing to people and in Palestinians, and also bringing to light the role that the U.S. government is playing in supporting and uncritically supporting what Israel does, not just morally, but also financially. Amnesty International on Friday published a statement calling for an embargo on arms sales to Israel, and they said Israel is carrying out a murderous assault against protesting Palestinians with its armed forces killing and maiming demonstrators who pose no imminent threat to them. And it's well established in U.S. and international humanitarian law that lethal force can only be used if there's an imminent threat to life. Even if a Palestinian was throwing stones or burning tires toward the border, that's not an imminent threat to the life of Israeli Defense Force soldiers, and that does not justify the use of deadly force. The UN Basic Principles on the Use of Force and Firearms by Law Enforcement says intentional lethal use of firearms may only be made when strictly unavoidable in order to protect life. Now, B'Tselem, which is the Israeli Human Rights Group, an anti-occupation human rights organization, has put out a call for Israeli soldiers to disobey patently illegal orders. It's called Sorry, Sir, I Can't Shoot. B'Tselem, again an Israeli human rights organization, stated that it's a criminal offense to obey patently illegal orders, and therefore as long as soldiers in the field continue to receive orders to use live fire against unarmed civilians, they are duty-bound to refuse to comply.
I'm afraid, yes. Mark, I'm going to have to interrupt. I'd like to keep on talking. Our time's run out. I think the question still remains, and something we've got to ask ourselves, what can we actually do about it? We know terrible things are happening, and if they're not stopped, they'll continue, won't they? So anyway, thank you for talking to us.
Thank you. You've put it so straightforwardly and legally. What is exactly happening? And we have to work up and wake up as a world. I don't think the IDF has received a single scratch over their five-week rampage. Not one injury between them.
No, I have not heard of any at all, and it really is an outrage. And on May 15th, there is reportedly going to be an escalation of the Palestinian demonstration. The reports are that they're going to go to the border, try to get over the border. And that is the day. That is the day of the Nakba. That's the day of the expulsion of the Palestinians to create Israel. Now, the Israeli government and the U.S. government, the New York Times, are saying that Hamas organized this great march of return. But it was in many different organizations from civil society. There were flags of many different organizations, but there was a report that Hamas, and this was in the Los Angeles Times, that the leader of Hamas, Ismail Haniyeh, has said that The protests are not going to end on May 15th, but they will continue. And on May 14th, which is the day before the Nakba, the U.S. embassy is set.
Is
set to move its embassy to Jerusalem. So that will make for a very volatile situation.
Yeah, we'd like to thank you so much for coming on air, Marjorie, and just cross your fingers that there's not too much bloodshed coming up over these next few weeks.
We'll just do our bit to try and keep the word, wake up people here.
Yes, well, I think that getting the word out, which is what you're doing and I'm doing, is really key. And thank you so much for inviting me.
Very kind of
you. Bye-bye.
Well, Martin, we're so fortunate to be able to talk to such a distinguished person. Isn't she wonderful, her public spirit?
She certainly is. No, there's so much awful news. Here is a good item of news. European governments have approved a proposal to widen a ban on neonicotinoid pesticides that studies have found are harmful to bees and other pollinators. The move completely bans the outdoor use of three neonicotinoids, or neonics, across the whole European Union. They are pesticides developed by and including Bayer and Syngenta. Really good news.
Very good news that governments will take on these powerful corporations for the common good. I mean, if we don't protect bees, we're not protecting our agriculture, which is basic to our food supply.
From us at Earthwise.
Goodbye.